It isn't perfect, what we have at the moment, but we've got to keep going. We've got to keep trying to make it work. I think that's me done.
Thank you. Very much. So, final speaker before the break is Dr. Sandra Leighton, from the Institute of Education here at UCL, who's going to tell us about big data and products. Leighton Gray, sorry.
So I didn't exactly have to get here because I'm the other end of the building. So I'm based in the Institute of Education, and what my job is, I'm a sociologist, and I've got a particular research interest in things like the sociology of technology, big data, and privacy. I think that there's three very big questions when we're thinking about privacy in relation to space and space science. The first one is how necessary or desirable is ownership, so we'll look at that. The second question is the way that we develop tech and how that impacts on the privacy world. And thirdly, what we consider to be surveillance. So starting with question one, so one form of privacy that we're all familiar with is the idea of territorial privacy, so the limits of other people's rights in a physical space. And territorial privacy is often linked to ownership rights. So for example, you might not be able to take pictures of certain public buildings or airports. You might not be able to come into my back garden and take pictures of my roses. I might not want you to do that because I own my house. I'd be very unhappy if you took my house away because I regard that as a form of private ownership. But do I own my house all the way down to the Earth's core? Do I own that land? Or can somebody have the bit underneath and I just have the house on top and somebody has the fracking rights underneath? I understand that they've just done that. They've just decided that's not my land anymore. So we're not just thinking up, we can think down as well. So when we think about space, we have this situation where we have a new domain. It's up for grabs. Nation states have stepped in, but it might not be in everybody's long-term interest to see it like that indefinitely. Similarly, we have private operators coming in, and other speakers have mentioned those today. Do we want the guy who owns Amazon also sending things up and having a look at what we're all doing and forming a view about what sort of data can be gathered and what sort of data can be sold? Is that how we want to move forward? And there's some really big things. So in view of the fact that you have this private involvement, and even in the case of nation states with space programs, you have private equipment sometimes forming part of that, perhaps the nation state's starting to become redundant here. We're extending the scope and remit of dominance, of education and social advantage on a much, much larger scale than people today have talked about the space race and how it continues. And when we think about big data, we think about multi-satellite constellations, collecting data about us potentially. But even if we can usefully analyze and deploy all of that data moving forward, and it's a very big haystack, and we're looking for a few needles sometimes, and we're looking at data on that too. Who is deciding which of those data matter, which should be privileged, and what's allowed and what isn't? So then you can imagine different forms of bias and different forms of unfairness almost being programmed into the way that we're looking at things. We have junk algorithms in and junk information out. So we have then, within this, small groups disadvantaged because we have the big players deciding what matters and small numbers of people perpetually disadvantaged. So your water rights may not be the rights that are looked at because somebody else decided the water rights next door and the impact of that is more interesting to formulate policy around. And it may be that each time, and that's just one example, each time that people are thinking about what needs to be observed and what needs to be analysed, that's just 1% of the people, a fringe, you know, who aren't considered, who aren't privileged in policy and analysis. But is that really okay? Because this may be 70 million people that we're talking about each time, and this may be their livelihoods. So that's the population greater than the size of the UK, and this may happen repeatedly. So we have to be very careful that we've got a very good understanding of the impact of these analysis algorithms on the kind of the way we're conceptualising how we want humanity to proceed. There's a very interesting project going on at Oxford and Nottingham Universities called the Unbiased Project that looks into this a bit more. So perhaps it's very complicated, overly complicated, to think that the nation state is a really important part of space's future. Maybe we do have to hand ourselves over to Facebook and Alphabet, scary as that may seem. And maybe that's undemocratic then. So what do we do? Maybe we have to think of new forms of democracy for handling this kind of data, handling privacy issues that go beyond all of this. And then we can perhaps decide how we avoid disadvantaging huge swathes of the global population because we've embedded all of this in a commercial or military model. But we're not there now. So things are really imbalanced. And it's at a time when things are very unsettled. I'll come back to the idea of balance later. So moving on to question two, is narcissism or egocentrism an intrinsic problem in tech development? Having worked in a tech unit for a while and doing a lot of sociology and technology, I can imagine the criticism saying this. But we have to think philosophically here. Is the development of new technology often a narcissistic act? People are privileged, they are applauded for deciding that something will be possible and doing the possible and implementing the possible and having impact. We privilege the shock of the new, sometimes at the expense of the stability of the old, and then it gets very scary. So rarely do you get applauded in the tech world for saying, well, you know, the ethics of that, I'm not sure. It's a question of do first, think about the ethics later, as we see, for example, with the development of artificial intelligence at the moment and some of the algorithm problems that are developing on the back of it. So what do you get applauded for? You get applauded for monetizing things and leveraging investment, particularly if it's 30 times the investment or more. Even if there's a case for arguing that there's some social damage that comes about. For example, predatory venture capitalists buying the rights to do things, and people who would have had a say or some agency in how that's used being completely overlooked or ignored. So we have to think about big data in that context. Mistakes become enormous. Everything's scaled to a volume that you just can't imagine. So the mistakes are much more damaging, and that's where we have to start disciplining our thinking. And it's born out of the desire to control. That's the centre of a lot of this development. And that means that you're controlling data, and you're controlling other people's data, and you're controlling their lives. And this can be made privacy friendly, but it's not the normal starting point. So moving on to question three, we're thinking about surveillance. So one person's simple monitoring, so looking at your water rides, looking at migration patterns, all sorts of things that you might want to do, that can be genuinely interesting or it can be pure interest. And trying to work out where the line is between those things, what's legitimate and what's nosy, is very, very fraught in the privacy world. This doesn't matter massively if the company trying to look at what you're doing is trying to find out what music you like, invite you to buy another piece of music, but it matters a lot more if they're looking at something really essential to your way of life, for example, water rights and agriculture patterns, or tracking you systematically across your natural roaming area just because they can. As if you're a kind of wildebeest in a natural history program or moving across the globe. So space assets do two things, really. They bring about security for us by being able to look at things that are happening and looking at people and looking at things. And they can make sure, perhaps, and I'm thinking a little bit in the future here, that we might be evacuated before a natural disaster strikes, or perhaps a war might become a problem or a border issue. And indeed, in one African country, we found that by looking at the way ambulances were used, because there was nothing much in the way of privacy legislation in that particular country, they were able to look in great detail. Reroute ambulances and save thousands of lives, so it's very useful. But the flip side is, how are we defining security? When does it become unwelcome surveillance, and when does it become oppression? Now, I'm in the privacy expert group of the Biometrics Institute, and we debate very many similar questions. But we've recently concluded that we need to have a naughty government check for most of these tools to avoid an exaggerated form of the kind of East German population surveillance that went on. But deciding exactly what form that should take is incredibly difficult. Now, the International Association of Privacy Professionals are a bit further ahead, and they have a very useful check for testing the legitimacy of monitoring. And it's quite sobering to apply this to monitoring conducted from space. There's 4 points. There's necessity. So does the objective, whatever it is, need to be achieved through monitoring? Could you do it in a less obtrusive way? There's legitimacy. So have you got legal grounds for doing this monitoring? There's proportionality. Have you got legal grounds? Given the objective, is the monitoring given the objective, is monitoring that kind of intrusion proportionate to the kind of outcome? The fourth one is transparency. Do the people who are being monitored know about it and the objective behind it? And when you apply this test to space-based collection of data, you run into a number of issues. So who's deciding the objective? So it might be the client, the state, the corporate player, perfectly reasonable, they're the ones that are paying. But should they be the people to conduct these tests? Do we need other organisations to be in place? Necessity, legitimacy, proportionality. Perhaps it should be the nation state through the mechanism of international law. Or should it be supranational bodies? Do we need new supranational bodies? And even when you've got that sorted, how do you provide the necessary transparency to the people on the ground who have no idea that they're being observed by a satellite? So, privacy is a really difficult thing to work through in this context. And we're thinking about privacy versus security, privacy versus freedom of expression and information, and also, quite often, individual rights versus collective rights. So we're balancing competing rights. We're balancing benefits to society, profits to corporations, and the use of big data, versus intrusion into our personal space and lives. So it's not a new problem. So I've listed something drafted by the OECD. So they've got privacy guidelines governing the protection of privacy and transport of flows of personal data. And they were written in 1980 on the back end of the 1967 Space Treaty. And they recognised that new forms of international cooperation and compatible approaches were going to be necessary. And we'll find some things embedded that link to the three big questions I raised earlier. And as I was preparing the slides for this, it felt very much like preparing an undergraduate lecture where I was taking people through heavy material. So I'll whiz through it very quickly. So the first one is the idea of collection limitation. So not complete freedom of data collection, as in the case of the 67 Treaty. But in practice, who can set limits on the data collected, and who will define proportionate use? We have the idea of data quality. And personal data, but whose definition of data quality should be used? We have the idea of purpose specification. Who can check whether the use is properly specified or that a specified purpose is followed? We have use limitation. How can the use be controlled? And so do we come back to the idea of cooperative international treaties again? Security safeguards, and we've heard about cyber. Will state actors always be some of the major players in international hacking? And if so, how will you enforce any of this? We have the idea of openness. How can you have transparency from a satellite miles above Earth and you don't even know it's there? So the idea of individual participation, similarly, how can you have data subject rights when you don't know who controls it? And finally, accountability. So with international international operations and control, who will have regulatory authority to hold the controlling organisation to account? So in the age of big data, the inherent and very nuanced balances have become incredibly complicated through the spread of multinational and supranational organisations. So we have a new dichotomy now, which is state actors versus multinational organisations or corporations. And it's not just their privacy, we see it in terms of taxation, so treasuries wondering how they're going to collect their tithe. But if companies are beyond the control of individual states, can the extant mechanisms of international law really apply here? Is that ever going to be sufficient? And are the enforcement mechanisms that we have sufficient, given that they primarily rely on the nation state? So as the technology of space and the capability of big data increase, in terms of both developmental speed and reach, can the legislative and sociological counterbalances keep pace? So there's no magic bullet. There won't be a single answer as to how we're going to balance all these rights of individuals, corporations, the state and other payers. There isn't on Earth, so we can't really expect there to be one in space. But at least on Earth, we have an idea of who's doing the balancing and who are the regulatory referees that we can call upon if we feel that we have a problem, if we don't like the conclusion. So the question here is not what the balance of privacy rights needs to be in space, but who should be judging the balance. And who should check that they've got it right. And that's it.
Thank you, Sandra. So that brings us to the end of our first session. We have now a 15-minute break. We will start very promptly at 4 o'clock.
4:15.
No, we'll start very properly at 5 minutes to 5 minutes to 4. So, Crystal, you don't need Connor Walsh from the National Resource Institute at Greenwich University, and Mark Jarman, the head of Earth Observation and Agri-Tech Lead at the Space.